lumber game.
Everyone is invited to sit down. And if you want to use a paper and a pencil, this is just a unique last week, this week. Complimentary help. But we're going through information. Alright, first of all, we're dedicating tonight's class to Geula ben Yosef, which is the Golian Patriarch, whose yahrzeit is in a couple of days. And we are learning the portion of Mishpatim, and we are up to the 11th step. So to continue from where we left off last week, the 11th step reads that we sought, we search through prayer to improve our contact with Hashem. And what do we want from that contact? First of all, we want to have contact. That's A. And B, we are also praying for knowledge of for Hashem's will, and then for the power to carry it out. Now there's no question that the knowledge of God's will empowers us to carry it out. Knowledge of God isn't like any other knowledge. Other knowledge is just knowledge. And between knowing and doing, we have this tremendous gap that we have to learn how to connect the knowing to the doing. The uniqueness of the knowledge of God is that the Talmud says, regarding the evil inclination, regarding the Yetzer Hara, that to a certain degree, every person's evil inclination is so great that without God's help, we can never overcome it. And how does God help us? So the Talmud says, through learning His Torah, Mishachayu Leveis HaMedrash, schlep the Yetzer Hara with you inside the house of study. So study, the knowledge of God, isn't only the knowledge of God, but the knowledge, since it is a godly knowledge, that it in itself empowers us to fulfill God's will. And as Jews, we have the tremendous privilege and merit of receiving the Torah. And so when we pray for the knowledge of God, it's like a person before a test is going to pray to do good on the test. First, study your homework. And after you did your part, then we still need God's help. Then you pray to get a good mark. So for a Jew, when it comes to the 11th step, of course, prayer is always needed. But first, do our part. Our part of the knowledge of God is learning the Torah. And like we mentioned last week, that the Torah is vast, it's endless, it's infinite. To a certain degree, one could say that the entire Torah is somehow imbued in the five books of Moses. There's a truth to that. And that in itself is somehow squeezed in the Ten Commandments. In other words, the Ten Commandments aren't the most important of the mitzvahs, but it's true to say that the entire knowledge of God is inside the Ten Commandments, inside the Aseret HaDibros. So part of the 11th step must be learning Torah. Torah has no beginning, Torah has no end. So as a good tip, learn the Ten Commandments, and you'll have a tremendous amount of divine knowledge. What we started doing last week is pointing out that which we learn in Kabbalah, that we find the number 10, it's a constant number. It's the most complete number, and it's a number that is used in various fundamental interactions between God and the world. The Mishnah tells us that God created the world with 10 sayings. We know in Kabbalah that God created first and foremost the 10 Sfiras, the 10 Sfirot, through which God created everything else. We just learned a couple of weeks ago that the Egyptians, as we explained, threw as a consequence of their immoral behavior, that resulted in nature also behaving immorally or unnaturally. And the specific 10 plagues correspond to the 10 corrupted Sfirot. And then what we added on last week was is that the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibros, are the means of one rectifying, of one's fixing of oneself. So we are very complex people, but we can say that everything within the human experience could be categorized within one of the ten sefirot. All of my experiences will be compact. If I want to divide them to understand it better, if I want to break it down, I need to break it down into the ten sefirot. So what we started doing last week, and the quick recap, and then we'll go on from where we left off, is to underline that the ten sefirot, and the ten sayings, and the ten plagues, and the ten commandments are all the same. And this is a tremendous key of knowledge. Because whenever we know, this is written in Zohar, whenever we know that there are ten, that they are parallel one to the other, so the way we will understand one better is by understanding the connection one has with the other. Superficially, some of these tens don't exactly fit, which is a good thing. So we're going to question, what's the connection? And that question, like any question, a question is a key. Questions are infinitely greater or more important than the answers. The answers we have a whole life to figure out. Right? The trick is to know what question to ask. That's more important than getting the right answer. Know how to ask the right questions. And when we put these together, as we started doing last week, we have questions. What is the connection? And the better we understand the connection, the more that is a sign that we are understanding the meaning of the ten spheres, that we are understanding the meaning of the ten plagues, that we are understanding the meaning of the ten sayings, and that we are understanding the meaning of the ten commandments. Alright, so let's go. We went through the first five last week, and I think we rushed. I don't know, I think we were going too quick. Let's slow down, and let's go through the last five. So instead of repeating what we did last week, I'll just start from the last five. We went backwards, and there's a reason for that. We'll leave it for another time. So we left off last week by the sixth commandment. When you're counting backwards, that means we did five. We did 10, and 9, and 8, and 7, right? 10, 9, 8, 7, I'm sorry, we did 4. So we left off by the sixth. The sixth commandment is don't murder. Thou shall not, whatever that means. Don't murder. And we said last week that don't murder corresponds to the saying that God said on the fourth day of creation, which is Tuesday night. What did God say Tuesday night? What was created on the fourth day? The luminaries and the heavens. And that corresponds to the sphere called Tiferet, or pronounced in modern Hebrew, Tiferet, which you can translate to mean either compassion, right, or beauty, mercy, and in the ten plagues, it corresponds to the plague of Devil, which was the epidemic. In other words, there was that plague that all of the animals, all of life, just died. People had no idea why. It was an epidemic. Now, let's understand the following. Thou shall not murder obviously means thou shall not murder in the literal sense, but let's not only keep the definition narrow as not to murder. There are many types of thou shall not murder. Judaism acknowledges very strongly and underlines very strongly, and unfortunately it's not yet the law of the land, even though we're living in an advanced civilization, that emotional murder or emotional pain is worse than physical pain. That's Jewish law. This is not to minimize physical pain, but it's just to underline that emotional pain is worse than physical pain. For example, today if a teacher in school would hit the child, I think they would go to jail. Not to hit the child, and God forbid, that's a bad thing. But there aren't any rules regarding a teacher hurting or hitting a child emotionally. Like in Jewish law, a teacher is allowed to hit the child. But a teacher is never allowed to put the child under any type of emotional duress. For example, the whole class is going on a trip, but you can't. Stand in the corner. Please pick up your hands and stand in the corner. I don't know, I'm going way back to my times. Whatever, it's up to anything that shames a child. anything that hurts the child emotionally is a lot worse than physical pain. And we all adults, we know that. I don't want to get sidetracked, but the very painful issue that is becoming a real issue, and not because it was under the rug many years ago. No, it's actually a lot more prevalent today, unfortunately, than in years before, is child molestation. It always existed, but it's an epidemic that unprecedented in history. And yeah, I heard many theories. I heard that being that we're living in a society that people are accepting, you know, there's no laws of modesty, so to say. Well, I'm not saying that when a society accepts the norms of modesty that exist today, and men and women are constantly being bombarded with sexual stimuli, there's going to be a consequence. People are constantly being instigated. And that's one of the reasons why many great people are understanding that the issue, we should just be aware of it, of adults molesting children, not that it always happened, unfortunately, but it's happening a lot more today. It's not the creep that does it. It's any person that you know is a potential molester. And the damage that happens to a child that gets molested is a spiritual death. They die. In the American legal system, if a child is not raped, if he was only touched by an adult, that person will not go to jail. It's a terrible thing. And we know cases of people who molested children, who admitted to it, who were taken to court and are walking free. Because there wasn't physical, whatever they define as the physical barrier wasn't crossed. The emotional distress that these people, if they are still children or they stay children and they are adults, they're dead. They're not only dead in the bedroom, they're dead. They're living dead people. That's part of thou shalt not murder, which is a tremendous challenge, because many people think that, you know, in the religious community, you know, people cover up these things, which is not true. No, we go to the authorities. The challenge that people have to know today is that going to the authorities does not resolve. It only resolves it when the law is taking action against it. And the law today, when something happened physically, we're going to put the guy in jail. If it only happened emotionally, all right, it's not the end of the world. And it's not true. Yes?
We do believe in the resurrection of the dead.
Yes. No, no question about this. Okay, so let me continue. I just want to add to that about those who are not murdered and the luminaries and the epidemic. And what's it connected to compassion? What does compassion have to do with the sphere? It has everything to do with it. You know, when people get abused, when people get murdered emotionally, when they get hurt, it's a lot more painful to be hurt by someone who loves you than by this evil stranger. Many people who came from a dysfunctional family where one of the parents were unfortunately evil. It's interesting to me, they made studies that the child is going to have more of an issue with a non-evil parent that they were enabling, that they didn't stop. Why don't they have this anger towards the evil one? Because, God forbid, nothing should ever happen to anyone. But if a person is hurt by an evil person, at least somewhere in one's mind it makes sense. Oh, that person is evil, that person is bad, and they're bad people do bad things. But a corrupted compassion, which is the plague of the epidemic, when compassionate people hurt you, the pain is infinitely worse. You know, when the Nazis went after us, that in itself was the end of the world. They killed 6 million of us. But what made it infinitely more cruel was that these people, after murdering men, women, and children during the whole day, they had normal lives. And they were compassionate people. And there were laws, not only compassionate, if they hurt an animal, they went to jail in Germany. That makes them much worse. At least if they're monsters 24/7, okay, you're dealing with a monster. God forbid never to have to deal with them and person who got killed is dead. And like Donna said, even physical death has a resurrection. There's always a resurrection. But it's much worse to get hurt by someone who's also compassionate towards you. So the reason why, by the plague, the one that manifested itself in death, the first one was blood. It wasn't death. It was blood. It was frogs. You had life. But death was this one was thou shalt not murder, was tifereth. And then death was the first, as we'll get to God willing later tonight. And it's very much connected to that. Because cruel compassion is a lot worse than evil. And the Egyptians had that. In other words, the cruelty that the Egyptians did to us, it wasn't that they were just evil, which they were. They were even a worser evil. They were compassionate, and then they were evil. And people don't know what to do with that. You look at a person, they're nice to you, and then they're evil to you. That totally messes a person up. Like your internal radar just goes, meshuggah. You don't know what to do with that. You don't know how to process that. I don't know how people can get over that. Yes, there's resurrection, but only with the help of God and with the therapy after many years. And it's a tremendous challenge. And on the other hand, we also have to understand that when Cain murdered Hevel, in the literal meaning, thou shalt not murder. So there's a very famous statement that God told Cain. God told Cain that the blood, plural, the blood of your brother is shouting out for me from the earth. Called the Mei Achicha. So Rashi says, why bloods? Why plural? He killed one person, which is terrible, but why plural? So, no, the answer is, Talmud says, when he murdered Hevel, you know who he murdered? He didn't just murder Hevel. He murdered Hevel and his kids and his grandkids and all of the life that would have come out of him. So a person is a luminary. A luminary is a great thing, and a luminary gives off light. And we look at every single human being, everything that God created is a luminary. Which means it's not only that it has its own intrinsic value, and the proof is God created it. That means God needs it. God needs that creature. What greater compliment can there exist for that? That is the ultimate worth. It exists, so it's needed by God. There's a divine purpose for it, which is why it is. But when a person hurts that, you're not only hurting the thing itself, but you're depriving the world from the life that this person would have given to the world. You know how advanced the world would have been today if not for the Holocaust? Everyone lost. You know how much life was taken away from the world, aside of the individual lives. So you see a correlation. That disrespecting another person, first of all, remember that the thou shalt not murder, it's connected to tiferet, it's connected to the deepest emotional sphira, the deepest emotional attribute for a very deep reason. Because thou shalt not murder, God didn't come to Sinai just to tell us don't murder, which is important. But it wasn't just don't murder, the way Cain murdered Hevel. Much deeper than that. Actually, don't murder a person emotionally. And the worst way we hurt others, you know, we end up hurting people who are closest to us, you know, just because they're such a thing, it doesn't justify it. It's a terrible thing. And we should be very careful of not hurting, let's put it on us, but we should be careful not hurting people who we are close to. Being close to someone gives a responsibility. The responsibility is that when a person looks at us as a compassionate person, even if we just don't smile at them sometimes, or we give them a cold good morning, they can get hurt from that. That's part of thou shalt not murder. And the opposite is, understand that every person has value, not only their own value, but every person is a luminary, which means every person has their contribution that only they can make to the world. Only they can make it to the world. And there's so many other side issues when it comes to thou shalt not murder, which is just endless. You know, you look at it today, we're living in a society that many people, to a certain degree, challenge thou shalt not murder. If it comes to euthanasia, which we can speak about this for 20 hours, you know, a person is very old, and terminally ill, and suffering, and you want to just take them out of the agony, and all of these gray areas, which is not for now, but the bottom line is that thou shalt not murder is a very straightforward commandment. Every creature is a luminary of God. As we know today, there are how many billions or trillion stars in the heavens, that's how many creatures we have here on earth. And everyone was created to give light. And everything that is here, and every person, you have your light, I have my light, and I have the power to make more of your light come out, and God forbid the opposite. When I hurt someone emotionally, I take away their light. I darken them, yes?
To further the metaphor, when stars, you know, quote unquote, die, they go supernova and create the you know, the elements essential for life that we know.
Correct.
And sort of see everything. So if you destroy that, you're destroying
So every human being has a lot more value that is externally apparent, which is why when a person externally doesn't seem to have any value, euthanasia and other cases, I don't want to give a blanket statement, but generally it's prohibited. A life is a life is a life. Now, I don't want to get sidetracked parenthetically, just to make it clear that when a person is on the state, there is a stage in halacha called a person who is dying. When a person is in that stage, when people tell you about Judaism, you always have to prolong the life of everyone regardless, always. That statement is not true either. There are certain times when a person is already in the process of dying, then there is no mitzvah to prolong the life. The concept of letting the person go exists in halachic Judaism, and God forbid we should never face these challenges, but if we have a family or friend member who's in that scenario, it's always good, the side of speaking to doctors, to find out what the Torah has to say. It's not never black and white, and you have to have a lot of Torah knowledge and a lot of medical knowledge to understand what the Torah, what halacha has to say regarding this or that situation. But coming back, all I want to do now is just to connect the dose on not murder, not just the physical murder, but to the deepest emotional sphere called tifedet, which is the deepest emotional trait called compassion and mercy. And the more compassionate we have, the more we are able to hurt people, and the more sensitive we need to train ourselves to be towards others. Alright, let's move on. Okay, the fifth commandment, we're going up, right from the tenth to the first. The fifth commandment is honor your father and your mother. The hardest commandment. If my parents watch this later, they'll be laughing when they hear. Honor your father and your mother. You know, everyone asks a question. For some reason, God didn't give the Ten Commandments on one tablet. God gave the Ten Commandments on two tablets. So it was five and five. And supposedly, the first five are between man and God, and the latter five are between man and man. Don't murder, right? Don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't be a false witness, don't even want what the others owe the other. Honor your father and your mother should have been between man and man. But it's put on the tablet that deals with laws between man and God. Now let's understand. So we have honor your father and your mother. What came before? We're going backwards. What would happen before God commanded the luminaries to be set in the heavens? What was the second thing that God created? Tuesday? Who remembers? Huh? The sun and the moon. That was the thou shalt not murder. We're going backwards now. We're going to the fifth saying. The fifth saying in creation, which was the second thing God said and He created on Tuesday, was vegetation. God commanded the earth to sprout forth vegetation, which is grass, which is trees and fruit. All vegetation came out. Right? A child from a parent, a fruit from a tree. We'll see soon a connection over here. In the Sfiras, we're going backwards, the Sfira of Gevura. Gevura, let's translate it as the tower of severity, or just being judgmental, or rejection. And when that attribute of rejecting or being judgmental is corrupted, what do you get? You get anger. Excess gevura gives you anger. And anger in the plague expressed itself with the plague of, we're going backwards now, the plague is the plague of new heaven. We're going to fight. No. We're going to the boils. We're going to shit. Just push it. It's red and it's anger. The person is very angry and they're talking or shouting or whatever you call that. Then, they're one piece of boil. The one red boil. That's anger. I say that the best. A person has an anger issue, ask one of your friends to film you today. Everyone has the film on the phone. Just someone should take a video of a person when they're angry. All you need to do is watch it. You'll never get angry again. I think that's a good technique. A person looks like an animal. Or halavai an animal. I don't know what we look like when we get angry. We're totally dehumanized. We dehumanize ourselves. It's anger. It's gevura. Now, what is gevura? Here's the challenge. What is gevura? And how do we fix anger by honoring your father and your mother? Ha. And we got to think. See, this is the key. So these are connected. This is what it says in Kabbalah. So honor your father and your mother. Okay, I get that connection to vegetation because there's like the source, and the source, the earth, gives forth new life. A tree gives forth fruit. Alright, superficially it's connected at least. But now we go to Gevurah. What is Gevurah? What is the power of differentiation, of judging, of separating? How is that connected to honoring one's parents? Anybody? Need help over here? You can do it, Herzl. Not too hard. This is the key.
The way we treat our parents is different from everyone else. Because they know how to get your man.
They know too?
How to get your man.
They know how to get your man. I'm sorry?
They push your buttons. Please.
They push your buttons. That's the reason. Yeah.
The closest to you, so you have to overcome.
Okay. Good. Yeah?
You said it's also separating?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm saying, listen, there's something here. People have to just knock on it. It's all of this and more, and a lot more. But the question is better than the answer. Listen, a couple of ideas. Idea number one. If you can interpret in modern words, the fifth commandment is to go do therapy. Because all overwhelming anger, uncontrolled anger, is, as a rule, rooted in something that happened in our childhood. Which is why we can't put a handle on it. You have this joke of these three Jews in Miami Beach, elderly women in Miami Beach get together, each one is speaking about their children. So one says that, gosh, because my child, for my birthday, he flew down his entire family to spend a week with me. So the other Jewish woman says, that's nothing. He says, when my child, for my birthday, they took me for a month somewhere on a cruise. And the third mother looked at them with compassion, and she had pity on her two friends. She says, but that's nothing. She says, my son is a high-powered attorney, and he goes to therapy three times a week. And you know who he speaks about exclusively? Me. So, how can God command us to honor your father and your mother? That's the question. Everyone asks the question.
This is the hardest commandment.
How can God ask you to honor if they earned their honor? If a person was blessed to have healthy parents, good parents, so then you don't need a commandment. It's natural. There's nothing more natural than a child loving the parent. And if, God forbid, a person was, for some reason, some divine reason, was born into a dysfunctional family, and the father and the mother did things actively or passively for which they should not be honored, and they hurt their children, then how can you tell such a child, the Ten Commandments are given to everyone. Everyone has to honor the father and the mother. You know why? If a person, God forbid, came from a dysfunctional home, what are you telling them? Well, they're very angry at you. You tell them, it says in the Bible, you got to honor your father. He was not me. God didn't mean me. Honor your father and your mother doesn't mean going. Honor your father and your mother means never call your parent by their name. Honor your father and your mother means that if they're carrying something, help them. Do things for them, serve them, don't disturb them. That goes for everyone. Every person is ordered and commanded to honor the father and the mother. In other words, it doesn't have to be earned. So the question is, but your parents, you have to give respect. Why do you have to respect your parents? If there's nothing to learn from them, let's say God forbid, let's be connected. There's nothing to learn from one's parents because God gave you life through them. The reason why it's in the first tablet is because ultimately that mitzvah is very much connected between man and God. Even though the mitzvah is to honor the father and the mother, no, it's connected between man and God because ultimately honoring the father and the mother in the worst case scenario is there because God gave me, you, everyone life through their father and the mother. A person has to have gevurah. Gevurah means the power of differentiation, of judgment, separating things. If parents are guilty for A, B, C, D, and E, it doesn't take away the reality that they are your parents. So when people master the power of gevura, which is judging, separating, not mixing everything in a challan bowl, then the person is able to honor one's father and one's mother, even when there are certain things, or God forbid, many things about them, which doesn't demand any respect and honor at all. Nevertheless, honor them first for the very fact that they're your parents. And that's the truth. So rectify gevura. People who have the ability of differentiating one thing and the other are people who will always be able to honor the parents regardless. Does that make sense?
Why is someone adopting information?
He's asking a very good question. It's a question, a halachic question. He wants to know, is the mitzvah of honoring your father and your mother, is that only on the biological father and the mother? What happens if a person was adopted? Do they have to honor their biological father and mother if they were given away for adoption, etc., etc.? So what we explained right now is that being that this commandment, which was put in the first tablet, is between man and God, I'm honoring God. I'm acknowledging that God created me through that man and through that woman. Then this mitzvah goes on the biological father and the mother. Having said that, obviously, if a person was adopted, they have to give tremendous honor and respect to the people who adopted them. First of all, I'm commanded to give respect to my fellow person. That goes to universal. Then there's a special mitzvah for me to love my fellow Jew. Then there's an additional mitzvah for me to acknowledge and to honor anyone who gave me something. You know, it says in Pirkei Avos that if a person teaches me one letter, not one verse, not one letter, you have to call them your master and your teacher. So imagine if a person raised you, how much honor, but that is earned honor. The novelty of the fifth commandment is that even if, God forbid, one's father and mother did everything wrong, in a bad way, not they didn't know better, they did the best they could. No. In the worst case scenario, there isn't an exception to this mitzvah. Everyone is commanded to honor one father and one mother. Why? Because they're your father and your mother. Honor them because of the fact that they are your father and your mother. Period. Stop there. That's a big power. That's a mental power and a tremendous emotional power that is called gevura, of separating things. Just because bad is bad, it doesn't take away from the good. And many people have a challenge with that. They mix everything together. You know, many times we make a mistake, and someone looks at us, and they judge us just for that mistake. We get very hurt from that. Because, yeah, we made mistakes. We're acknowledging that. But no one wants to be judged only based on the mistake that they made. No, don't highlight that and see that and define me by the one mistake that I made, or by the 100 mistakes that I made, or whatever the number is. Yes, part of me makes mistakes, but part of me is good, and part of me is divine. And I would hope that when a person looks at me, they don't only see my weak points, they see all of me. So a tzaddik will only see my good parts, okay? But I don't expect everyone to be a tzaddik. But, you know, everyone feels wrong when people look at them and they take one bad thing and then it overwhelms everything else. We don't look at ourselves that way. We see our flaws. But we live with ourselves, most of us, quite well. Because we say, listen, we got to do a lot of fixing, we got to do a lot of work in these areas, but most people have a redeeming factor. At least, I'm a good guy. At least, whatever the at least is. And if that's the way we would like people to look at us, that's obviously the way we should look at others, and that is called in Kabbalah, gevura, the power of separating. Of separating one from the other. A right doesn't, two wrongs don't make. Now, over gevura, too much gevura. In other words, if I'm not going to honor my father and my mother, because I have a lot of child issues, because they were wrong, these people are going to have anger issues. And they're going to become a boil. So God says, go to therapy and figure out a way to honor your father and your mother. You hate them? Go fix that. The more you're going to honor your father and your mother, even if they don't deserve it, the less anger you're going to have in your life. Get rid of your boils. Yes?
If someone's parents decide they don't want any contact with their child, would you consider honoring them by respecting them?
That's a good question. I think I don't think you can give a blanket answer to that. There are many. You have to find out more information. Sometimes parents do that because they are mentally not well, and if they're mentally not well, then they need your help. Then there are times that even when a parent is mentally not well, the Talmud tells you stories that can make your hair stand. How great tzaddikim honored their parents. Even their parents used to shame them and used to do terrible things to them, and they gave them tremendous honor. It's a mitzvah that it's the hardest mitzvah. And I'm not saying many people here do a good job at it, but there's a lot of growth in that area. We can do it a lot better. Yeah.
When you say kavod mitzvah, doesn't it mean that
to love them? Doesn't mean to love them.
No. But if you don't have the five commandments before it, this commandment doesn't exist. It's only for five people to really learn the Torah.
No. God forbid. Whoa.
If somebody doesn't learn Torah.
Yeah.
And grow up in a dysfunctional family. Right?
Yes.
And doesn't know that there is a God.
Yes.
And doesn't know that everything is from the sky. If you've been chosen for you.
Yes.
If you want or not want, and you don't have nothing Kabbalah. You just come to this world and you get beat up and molested and everything.
Yes.
And you open your eyes and you are 32 years old and you have nothing in your life basically.
Yeah.
You want me to respect my parents that molest me or beat me up. It doesn't exist unless you understand that there is a power that puts it for you for it.
May I agree with you 100%? 100%. No, I agree with that. I'm saying that the fifth commandment, you're right.
The fifth commandment
one can keep only if in modern verbiage, God is telling you, go to therapy. When God tells across the blanket, honor your father and your mother, God is telling you, the mankind, go to therapy. And go back to your childhood. And go fix what needs to be fixed, and you'll get rid of your anger and your gavura, and everything will be a lot easier. You'll deal with life a lot better. I fully agree with you. Yes.
Yes, but that example that is Esau.
Yes.
Greatest character
of Kibbutz Aim. Oh,
it's like the greatest
lesson. Kibbutz Aim is not the only commandment.
No, I'm saying like the fact that he hated God.
Let's not say that he hated God, first of all. Second of all, you make a good point. A couple of just counters. That Esau's parents were great parents. I'm not minimizing his myths. But he did it. He went beyond what most people did.
The question is, though, Yaakov, was there an instance, no matter what, that you could go over Kibbutz Aim? When Yaakov didn't have the greatest reason to trick his father, he still wanted to trick his father.
Okay. So I didn't say there's no reason not, so let's just clarify what I'm saying. So when one's parent tells a person, eat non-kosher foods, which is what you were referring to, and to a certain degree what you're referring to, means if there's a clear commandment of God to do A, and the parent clearly tells you to do B, then I'm obligated to listen to God.
And when we're talking about Yitzhak Avinu was one thing.
It's very rare that this scenario happens. One of those rare scenarios was the scenario that we were talking about. I'm sorry?
What was his
tether? His tether was that he was listening to his mother.
Over his father.
And his mother was fulfilling the words of a prophet. The prophet was Shane, who spoke to her while she was pregnant. So there's a whole history behind Noah's. She came, basically, she was representing God. And she was saying that, I know from God that this is what God wants for me. And God comes before the Father, which was that case, to answer your halakhic question.
Right, but the words of your question is Kibbutz Aim and then.
Correct.
Not your father and then your mother.
But first God, correct?
Correct.
Okay. God told Rivka while she was pregnant that the younger son is going to be superior to the older son.
Why didn't the opposite tell that to
his father? Because there's a rule by prophecy that a prophet can only divulge info if they were told to God to divulge, to share that information. If they were told by God and they don't, they get punished. And if they share information, if they didn't have permission, they also get punished. The fact that Shane told this to Rivka and Yitzchak didn't know, because when Rivka, the pregnancy, let me just go fill everyone in. When Rivka was pregnant, the Torah records that she felt, only a mother, she felt something is wrong. And it's an amazing thing watching. She was very spiritually sensitive. What she felt the inclination of her child, that the child was attracted both to holy things and to unholy things. It's an amazing power. Women have this when they're pregnant, and especially a holy woman like Rivka. And she was very disturbed by that. In other words, like the Rashi says, if she would have felt that her child is attracted to bad, alright, she would have dealt with it. What made it worse was the schizophrenic. She felt that he's attracted to books. Now, she was bothered by it, and she shared her worry with her husband, Yitzchak. Yitzchak had no answer to her. So, at that time, the son of Noah was still alive. His name was Shem. Semites were his descendants. Imagine how old he must have been. Alright? You're talking about Shem was 9 generations before Abraham. That means he was 10 generations back from Isaac and Rivka. 10 generations. Many people here have the merit to know their grandparents. And a few of us had the merit to go back 4, right? Great grandparents. I don't think anyone, more, I don't know if anyone goes back 5 generations. He's going back 10 generations. She went to Shem, who was a prophet. And she told Shem, this is what I'm feeling. Can you please enlighten me? And Shem, as a prophet, told her that you have twins, and each one is going to go on a different path. One is going to eventually live out his life of God, and one is going to live out a very ungodly life. And she told him, the younger one, at the end, he has to overrule this, obviously. The good has to overrule bad. So Rivka understood, this is what we have in the Talmud, that since Yitzchak did not know that, she did not want to tell it to him. Which is another whole interesting discussion. About marriage and relationships, should you discuss everything, should you divulge everything, information for everyone? Here there's certain cases that she felt that telling it to her husband would be very hurtful. And by the very fact that this information only can come from a prophet, and her husband, who was a prophet, was not told this by God, she felt that God doesn't want him to know. And this goes on later on also. Remember when Joseph was sold and they didn't tell Jacob? This is a whole different conversation, but basically just to answer his question, that the explanation, the halachic explanation of how can Jacob go against his dad, fool his dad, was because God told him so.
It's not a question of it.
Yes.
First your father, then your mother.
Yes.
And who is God? So far to Jacob. And Jacob, you should first of all respect his father before his mother.
So may I just answer that question? The answer is that before the father and the mother, it comes God, correct?
Yeah.
The words of Rivka were the words of God. I just explained where did God tell her?
I understand what you're saying, but Jacob didn't know it.
Jacob knew that.
No.
Because when Jacob...
Jacob can't do that. And then the rest will come here.
So when you have a mother who's a woman, who's a righteous woman, who knows Torah, and you tell your mom, I can't do that because I'm going against dad, and she says, no, you have to do it. So if you have an average mother, so you tell her, no, I can't. But when your mother is a woman, that's what Tzidkani is, and she knows that you cannot go against the father, and he tells her that, and she says, no, you have to do this, he understood that he has to do it. For those people who have a mother, that's a Tzidkani, is who understand. So let's go on over here.
But I think you should dedicate one full class for this.
I know.
This is a very interesting.
Correct. Yes.
Last question.
Yes.
Father or grandfather? Who should I respect
first? Father.
Father.
Yes. And let's understand one thing, just to close this with this, that, you know, when you go, if your father tells you to go against the will of God, you got to listen to God first. I can tell people that 99.99% of times, if we have a little bit of seichel, a little bit of wisdom, we can honor both. Many people use this, too many people use this as a means of dishonoring one's parents. And as a rule, religion is here to make family stronger. And if you ever notice someone who's becoming religious, and because of them becoming more religious, there is less respect to the parents, they are on a wrong track. Alright, there are very, very few exceptions. Many people go, but it says you gotta listen to God first. You can listen to God, and you can figure out a way how to fully honor your father and your mother. And in the long run, for those people who have the wisdom, and you don't have to be Solomon, you have to just put some effort in to learn how to honor God and honor your father and your mother, then your journey towards Judaism is going to be contagious. Your parents will become more observant. And God forbid the opposite. Those people who become religious, or those people who direct others in becoming religious, and they somehow verbally, non-verbally, insinuating, explicit, implicit. They disconnect them from their families. They do a tremendous, what's called in Hebrew, chilul Hashem. They desecrate God's name. At the end of the day, if you're more religious, the result needs to be that you're going to honor your father and your mother more, like Meir said before. That goes to many other areas of life. If you become more observant, you have to be more joyful. That you have to make yourself happy. It's a good measuring stick. If you're feeling happier, if you're a happier person, you're on the right path. If you're becoming more observant and you're becoming, you know, more closed and blank, you're on the wrong path. God is life, God is joy, God is happiness, and God is family. So one comes with the other. Okay, let's move on. The commandment before that is the commandment of Saturday, Shabbos. Yes?
What's the connection with
boils? Boils is gevura, that's not rectified. I'm connecting boils to anger, and anger has to do with an unfixed childhood. And anger, angry people are angry at their parents. You don't have to dig that deep to get there. You'll get there quite quick, actually. Okay, let's go back. The fourth commandment is the commandment of Shabbos. The commandment of Shabbos is the first thing that God created on Tuesday. God said, may the waters gather. Water. Water is chesed in Kabbalah. Chesed means either love, kindness, giving. And if it's perverted, if it's wronged, then you have water, but it's frozen. That's ice. That was the plague of butter, right? Of the ice. If there's a fire, the fire is to yourself, selfish love. But outside to the other, it's the water, but it's cold, it's frozen. Frozen love. So what's the connection between chesed? What's the connection between being loving versus selfish with Shabbos? It's a key. What does chesed have to do with Shabbos? What does love have to do with Shabbos? What is ice? Is the water icy? Are you selfless? Are you selfish? Why is that Shabbos? Yes?
Shabbos is the ultimate gift that God gave us.
I mean, okay, so good. So Shabbos is the greatest kindness that God bestowed to us in Shabbos. Yes?
You can't do on Shabbos if we give everything for Shabbos.
Okay, you can't get from Shabbos.
Like
good. You give to Shabbos. Good. No, I'm saying there's something here. What else?
You're supposed to kill out on Shabbos.
And what does that have to do with love? Huh? What? No, think. Stay focused. You know something interesting? I want to I missed that. Let me tell you something beautiful. The Al Tereb, huh? I missed that. That's funny. The Al Tereb in chapter 32, you know, it's a big chapter. The Al Tereb deals with this. Hey, God says, you love your fellow Jew just like you love yourself. Sounds so beautiful. But come on. How can you love someone else the way you love yourself? God can tell you be nice, get it, share, good. God is telling you to love someone else the way you love yourself. How is that possible? So the Al Tereb says that we are physical and we are spiritual. There is the matter and the spirit. There is the earthliness and the heavenliness. If we are both. And everything has to be balanced. The question is, what is the main? What is the primary and what's secondary? If a person's primary relationship towards the world is towards the earthliness in the world, if when I relate to you, I'm relating primarily to your physical part, my physicality, me and you are two physical beings. And if we're two, I can never love you the way I love myself. It's not possible. However, if my way of understanding the world, if when I look out there, I'm looking for the spirit in everything, I'm making the heavenly part the primary part. So when I'm relating to another human being, I'm primarily relating to their spiritual part. Your soul and my soul is the same soul. The Jewish people have one soul. So I love you exactly the way I love myself. You know why? Because me and you are the same. We're part of the same self. And that's how the Alter Rebbe says that, why did Rabbi Akiva say that this mitzvah of loving your fellow Jew the way you love yourself, that is the cardinal mitzvah, that's the principal mitzvah of all the Torah. He says why? He asks, you know, that might be the Facebook, the face of all of the mitzvahs between man and man. Be nice, love, beautiful. What about keeping kosher? What does that have to do with loving your fellow? What about all the mitzvahs that are between man and God? So he explains, no, it's the principle of the whole Torah. Because the whole Torah is here to make a person focus on the spiritual more than focusing on the material. And again, how do I know that I got there? If I'm ever able to selflessly love someone else, that's only because I'm looking at their spirit. I'm a more spiritual person. If I'm a dominantly material person, I can be great, I can love, but there's always going to be a little bit of an agenda. There's always going to be a catch. And I have to benefit. And I'll never love you the way I love me, because you are you and me and me. We're two different people. But Chevra, this is exactly what Shabbos is all about. Shabbos, more than any other mitzvah, What is Shabbos trying to do to a person? I'm not talking about the letter of the law. I'm talking about the spirit of Shabbos. What Shabbos? Shabbos is a day that we are only prohibited of engaging in material creation. We cannot develop anything materially. We're advocated, we are encouraged to develop, to create anything which is spiritual. It's a day of learning. It's a day of developing new ideas. It's a day of bonding more with your fellow person. It's a day to spend family together. It's a day to experience a connection to God deeper. In order for me to be able to do that, I have to disconnect myself from the material world. All the prohibitions of Shabbos is connected to the material. No spiritual prohibition on Shabbos. Zero. Can't create. I can create ideas. I can create emotions. A mitzvah to do that on Shabbos. So Shabbos is a mitzvah that enables me to celebrate the spirit over matter. And by the way, that's so symbolic. You know what brings Shabbos in our homes is the lighting of the candles, which is primarily by Jewish custom, not by Jewish law. By Jewish custom, it's a mitzvah for the woman. Just to mention, tonight is the Rebbe Lubavitcher Rebbe's wife's day of passing. And lighting Shabbos candles is so powerful. I want you to know this. Halachically, opening up a light is 100% the mitzvah. If a woman is in the hospital for good reasons, or God forbid not, and here today in hospitals you're not allowed to light candles because of the oxygen, a woman makes a blessing and she opens up the light. Hanukkah, we don't do that. All right, halachically, you can't make the blessing on an electric menorah. Kid, you got to light a candle. Shabbos, halachically, you can light just make light. And more than that, just parenthetically, Shabbos, it's a mitzvah for there to be light in every area that you will be. Not in your bedroom, you won't be able to sleep. So aside of the traditional lighting of the candles, if a person has a larger home, there's a mitzvah to put, since we're not allowed to put on the lights on Shabbos, part of the mitzvah of lighting candles is to make sure that your house is lit up. So you don't trip when you're walking up the stairs, you don't trip, you don't get hurt. To bring light on the whole house. And that doesn't have to be done by candles, but Alpi Kabbalah, the reason why traditionally we light candles and we don't open up the light bulb is because, well, you know what a candle is? Where does the wax go? What happens to the candle? It becomes spirit. If you want to witness something that is material, it's clear that the material is serving the spiritual. Light is spiritual, and you're taking a physical thing and you're watching it transform itself to spiritual. This is how, that's why we bring Shabbos in with the candle. Not only for the light, we want to see that. This is Shabbos. Shabbos is like you were saying, you're taking the material of the whole week and you're saying, you know what, that all that was very good, but that's a means to an end. And I'm going to try to use every material scene that I acquired during the week for Shabbos. So you find good food, when should you eat it? On Shabbos. Shabbos is real selflessness, spirit over matter. That then, when a person is in that state, then they fix their chesed. I can love you when I see you as a spiritual being. I'm not ignoring the physical part. Everything has to be properly balanced, but it's what's the main and what's the secondary. What is the means? What's the end? Who's supreme? And by the way, we all struggle with that. We might think we don't. We do. And Shabbos is the real healer. I'm not talking about keeping the letter of the law here. We're speaking about keeping the letter of the law, which is the beginning, and the spirit of the law. Because many people can keep Shabbos 1,000% halachically and can miss the whole Shabbos. It's not Shabbos. You can do that. So we're not talking about that. But the concept of really keeping Shabbos, if I have to end, I have to close my Shabbos with a feeling that I'm elevated. And okay, you got it. God wants me to be in a more physical world. That's my mission, and I'll do it with joy. But you gotta, you have to experience a certain spiritual height or high on Shabbos, and then you can really love another person. Only then, selflessly. Okay, let's move up. Water. Water is a symbol of love. Water in the physical world. Let's say earth and water, which is the third day. So earth, even though that they're all connected, but every grain of sand is separated. Division. Physical things are divided. Water, I mean, I'm sure a biologist will tell you it's also, but to the naked eye, it's one, it's all connected. It's one body of water. And water connects other things. And water always goes from, naturally, from someplace high to someplace low. So there's always be a leak in the house. But the biggest challenge is to make a good gutter. If not, the water is going to leak. And no, it's water, because givers, they always give. And not only to their equals, they give down. And many, many, many other reasons. The Kabbalah, the symbol of love, is water. Let's move up. The third commandment, oh, you give off the plate. The third commandment is the commandment of don't take God's name in vain. And we said last week, by the way, so many people say that, gosh, God should have scratched that out of the Ten Commandments. Don't take God. Does God care if you take His name in vain? What do you think? Well, obviously He does. I mean, He said not to do it. But what's your meaning? Well, don't take my name in vain. Well, what does that mean? Huh?
It destroys respect.
So many people argue that you shouldn't respect be like in your heart. So here's the hierarchy world. There is the higher person, the lower person. Let's say that your word is the end. The goal of faith in God. Faith is powerful when you digest it, when you internalize it, when it affects your behavior, even the way you speak. Many people can have the first two commandments. They can really believe in a God, but they're stuck. The faith is in their world of faith, but they don't chew it. They don't digest it, which is bina, dissecting something, understanding it. If I want to make God, the faith that we all have in God real, to the point that even when I speak, you can see, here speaks a person who believes in God. Now, if a person speaks disrespectfully, it doesn't mean they don't believe in God. But those people, unfortunately, did not yet bring down what they have up there to the way they behave. And the connector is called in Kabbalah Bina. Bina is the power of, it's the woman, it's the mother that develops a baby. You develop, it's an intellectual power, taking a kernel, taking a general concept, there's a God, and applying it. And analyzing it, going into breaking it down, process it. Now, the plague of Bina, which is a plague when people overprocess things. Sometimes you overprocess things, you get so tumult, you get confused by the details. That's an unrectified Bina. Right? That's the locust. That's a bad thing. So when a person begins to process something, it's always important to begin and to end knowing where the idea came from, and what is it that I want through this process. I have to always connect the beginning and the end. But the sandwich is the process. So over binah, people know certain people, they overprocess things. They chew things again and again and again, and they break it down and they drown in it. That's not healthy. But a rectified bina, a healthy bina. So what did God create? God created, going back now, the second day, God created the rakia. The rakia divided the higher from the lower. The rakia doesn't only divide the higher and the lower, it actually connects the higher and the lower. There is a higher and there is a lower. But how do you connect what's up here to down here? Through talking about it, through speaking about it, through processing it. All modern therapy is bina. You're taking something and you're talking about it, you're understanding it better. And it really, it does something. It takes something which is up there and it draws it down. Alright, so to move back, because we're getting late to this, the second commandment was the commandment of don't have other gods. The Sfira is the Sfira of Chachma. The saying is the saying of there should be light, because that's what Chachma is, that first spark of life. You had a question and then, aha! I get the answer before you break it down, the general picture. And that aha is what, that light. And the aha is always connected, dependent on a person being open for there being a higher power, for a person believing in God. People who make idols, and the idols that we make is, I'm the idol, I'm God, I'm a self-made person. People who idolatrize themselves, God says don't make idols. The idol of power was he thought he's God. We are self-sufficient. I can make it on my own. That will darken my chachma. Chachma is dependent. Everyone wants to have chachma. Most of us have bina. So if God gave you an IQ of 160, God bless you. If you have an IQ of 120, you'll do fine as well. So we have bina. It's a question of quantity. How much bina do we have? But chachma, ooh, intuition, the power of conception, to invent, to get an idea that no one had before, to go fishing in the world of chachma, everyone is envious of that. That, what does it depend on? It depends on the acceptance of a higher power. And in the negative, not to make yourself into an idol. Not to make the wrong things into the higher power. When you are off in that, then you lose your chachma. If a person is in the dark, I'm trying to get the real root of something and I can't, that's a sign that I'm connected to some type of spiritual idolatry. There is something that I'm giving too much value to. I'm making that into a god. That's why I'm in the dark. Once we take out idolatry, automatically I'm in the light. And the first commandment is the commandment of I am God. And the I am God is connected to the first saying when God made that first general statement of God created everything. Bereishis bara elokim. And that corresponds to the sphere of Kesed, which is called the superconscious, which is the beginning of everything. Or God forbid, if that is hurt, then it's the death of everything, the death of the beginning. The beginning is the firstborn, is the beginning. And this is a whole other class. If you think Shabbos or honoring your father and your mother, this concept that we believe that there is an infinite God and that finite beings, we can connect to the infinite God, because you know what God said? God didn't say that I am. God says, I am your God. Anochi Hashem? Your God. That something finite can connect to something infinite. And it's not going to compromise the infinity, and it's not going to overwhelm the finite. That's a miracle. But that's what we believe in. We actually believe that we can have a relationship with something infinite. Not we can only relate to the finite part of God. No, we can connect to the infinity in God. Infinity and finitude kiss. That's the first commandment. And that's a very Jewish way of thinking. Most people believe in a higher power, but they don't believe that we can have a connection to this higher power. Or we can't have a connection to the infinite part of the highest power, because how can something infinite and something finite have a connection? It's not possible. It's possible. And it's miraculous, because when we connect ourselves to something infinite, it's the beginning of all healing. Because the concept of infinity is that there's no limits. So even if a person reaches a point in life where resurrection, where by the laws of nature it's finished, kaput, it's dead, with God, life is, and death, it's all the same. Spiritual, physical is all the same. Being, not being is all the same. It's infinite. So, and we have a power to tap into that. And when we tap into the first commandment, that's the greatest miracle of all miracles. And if we don't believe in the first commandment, that's the beginning of the death of everything. So a Jew believes that we have the power to connect ourselves to the infinity of God. And we can still exist. It's not going to overwhelm us. We won't be compromised. God won't be compromised. And we'll have a healthy relationship. And that's going to happen with the coming of Mashiach to the fullest extent. But now, before we experience it, we really believe that it can happen. Which is why we believe in the resurrection. We believe that everything is possible. Everyone believes that for God everything is possible. But we believe that being that we can have a relationship with an infinite God, so as long as we are connected to an infinite God, through us, everything is possible as well. And going back to the 12 steps, so if in my life, if it's impossible for me to change my day, it's impossible. The answer is you're right, it's impossible, but the moment I'm connected to God, it will become possible. Not because of me, because of God. And that goes to any area in life. And the power that faith gives a person, the joy that faith gives a person, the hope that faith gives a person. And we all have that. We are born with this faith. We don't have to buy into it. Every person is born with them because our souls know it. We have to think about it more. We have to speak about it more. We have to, it's just the first commandment. You have to talk about it. We got to study about God. We got to keep the mitzvahs. We got to do what God wants from a Jew to do, and that will bring down this faith, and I'll internalize it more, and that will heal everything. So that's the beginning, and that's the end. We'll stop here, and tomorrow, God willing, we'll go on with the 12th step. Back to normal.
Regarding like if something's possible for you, but if it's possible for Hashem, you believe in that.
True you.
Right.
True so, you.
Right. No, but I mean, you're talking about something like, I know Hashem, I'm not like, you know, yeah. I'm people like, I. You're I feel like. I have like a personal heart, it's like something that like in my own life would be impossible, but my Shemdai believing as a prophet, there's still a part of me that like, I can't stop because I never saw the possibility, even though like it's
a lot.
Yeah. So how do you
like, solution is Vina. Vina's learning. You have to learn. So to bring in, you have to. Yeah.
Once you acknowledge that, what's the second answer? Well, you don't have other. I mean, if you acknowledge the first,
that's why that's the answer. The explanation is that people can believe in God. They believe in God and believe in themselves as well. So no, idolatry is not a denial of God. Not a denial of God. But to prioritize.
Let's say we have many gods. Stars, what did that
act the day? We have the same thing. So I believe in God, but I believe in my power. I also have a power. And sometimes I have to acknowledge that I have zero power to better connect to God for God to do something infinite in my life. So in other words, there's a certain idol, exactly, that even in believing in God, you can still serve an idol. Even when you believe in God.
You feel like I go straight to God, I don't need,
people
make kibbutz and nikim as their God.
Have to be careful how to do that.
You know what I'm saying?
Have to be careful how to do that. First of all, you're asking something to God on your way out. That's a different discussion. Be very careful. But let's begin with me. Every person makes themselves into a little God. Most of them.
Yeah.
And so I believe in God, but I am. And it's true. And in those areas in my life that my I am ain't functioning, I have to become goodness.
Yeah.
that you got to go back to. You got to go back to God. There's nothing other than God. Then.
I'm really stuck on the daily basis.
That's the second commandment.
Kabbalah says a lot about the Nachash, which is the sin, and then if you add